According to a 2023 study by the American Council on Education, the nation's leading colleges and universities will be facing significant turnover at the presidential and chancellor level due to a combination of factors, including aging, lack of interest by chief academic officers to take the job, and frankly, it's not an appealing position. Furthermore, the presidential tenures are now averaging less than 6 years, and more than half of those expect to leave the position within the next 5 years. This is a big talent pool. A poor transition can impact the institution in ways that are potentially embarrassing and, frankly, catastrophic, having long-standing implications for institutional reputation, as well as institutional leadership continuity. On today's show, our guests are Dr. Pat Sanagan and Dr. Karen Whitney, and they are two of the co-authors of the new book, Onboarding the Transitional Presidency, A New Imperative for the Interim President. Pat and Karen believe that now is the time to normalize the benefits of an interim president, especially as it relates to the long-term transitional success for campus leadership. This was a great conversation, and whether you want to be a president or not, I think it's an important conversation for all of us in higher ed to take in. And I know you will enjoy it. So before we get into what's really this is about, I need to ask you this question. As an interim and having worked as an interim, does this make you better at cocktail parties? Because I think one of the biggest anxiety factors is going to a cocktail party with people they don't know. Like, well, how am I going to start this? Like, well, if you do, how am I going to start this for a job? Doesn't that make you better at it? What do you think?
Well, The way I say it, because I, particularly if it's a cocktail party of regular folks, people outside of higher ed, I'll say that if someone says, oh, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'll give them my bio for 2 seconds. And then I'll say, well, currently I often am a temp president. And they're like, temp president? So I try to use a word that we would know in regular circles. And this idea, then I use the appropriate language of transitional and consequential. Yeah. But I try to grab their attention because most folks, and why would you, and even people in higher ed, don't think about this space. They haven't had it yet. Right. They haven't experienced it. Or even if they had maybe a vice president or president who was interim, they didn't know it because the person is just doing their job. So in a way, at the cocktail party, it does get the scrunchy face, which I love. And then it kind of allows for a fun conversation about, oh, do tell. And how is that different? And so that's my answer, Laura.
That's cool. Pat, you're the key author of this book, Onboarding the Transitional Presidency, A New Imperative for Interim Presidents. This is not your first book. You've written several books and that sort of thing. Why is this such an important book right now for the Academy? And why did you pull Karen and others into this to make sure this hits out and people are have it in their hot little hands?
Couple quick things. I was a board member of a college in Minnesota for several years, and I saw a sister institution bring in an interim, and it was a catastrophe.
Right.
It was a cultural mismatch. I mean, someone who'd had two presidencies behind him, I think, assumed that he knew everything, and he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it piqued my interest. And then when I look at my other books I've written, I didn't write anything really about interims, and yet there's hundreds and hundreds of interims. Because the presidency has gotten a lot more difficult and people are leaving in droves.
Right.
We've got two great examples of the University of Penn and Harvard. They're gone. You're going to bring new people in after there's been a pretty tough situation. And then my alma mater is Temple University, and we had something about 6 months ago. But
yeah.
It was brutal to watch. So these transitions are going to happen. And I think the biggest shift that Karen and I had with our authors, I was very smart, Laura, in that I worked with other presidents, right? So everybody who was an author, I've never been a president. It's a really smart strategy, and we just talked about how can we make these people successful? Because if you bring an interim in for a year or 2 years, now it's 2 years, almost 3 years sometimes,
right?
Do a lot of good. They can elevate the institution, or they can do a lot of damage. And then a new person comes in who's permanent, and either the table is set for them, or they got to clean up the table. So we wanted to help people with real practical things, not the theories. We know the theories, we're great researchers, but we said, what's a half a dozen or 10 of these strategies that we can use to make these transitional leaders successful? And I think, as you alluded to before, it's mm-hmm. good for senior leaders too. I mean, it's for presidents and provosts and deans.
Yeah.
And things.
Well, and I want to call people's attention on the day we're recording this, the announcement came out. I'm in the Boston metro area, as many of my ongoing listeners know. Emmanuel College, which is a small Catholic institution, has just announced their appointment of a permanent president. And it is somebody who was an internal interim. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the nuances there in this conversation. But they came off of, Sister Janet was the president at Emmanuel since for decades. Forever, and was, yeah. She was the longest sitting president in the country. And that was actually something when they appointed someone from the outside, having some experience working with interims, I said, this is not going to work well. You've got just from a cultural standpoint, you cannot fill a position after someone's been there that long and expect that this is going to go smoothly. Your book is out now during a time where we are in eyeball deep. We're not coming up on. We are eyeball deep in a dearth of open positions that are going to continue to get open. And these openings only have so many good candidates.
Yes.
And so let's talk about that interim. And the book is about interims and transitions, but we want to talk about the importance of reevaluating how an interim can actually position the institution for a smooth transition. But I want to focus on the talent pool for a minute. Both of you have experience in this. Both of you are seeing this. Talk to us about why the talent pool is such an important thing to acknowledge as we're going into this idea of an interim. So Karen or Pat, you can start.
Go ahead, please. Well, I think in terms of talent pool, there's a lock and key relationship. There's the pool itself, and then there is the institution ready for the next leader and right. for the talent. And I mean, unfortunately, in higher ed, in Whitney world, and this is, I earned this through years now. I do executive coaching. I'm a member of the registry. I rep for them. I mean, I'm saying this from years now, working with Pat on our project. So I don't say this just because I have an opinion. It's observational. Many institutions are not ready to secure the next regularly appointed leader. They might think they're ready. They present lovely portfolios of the position, but they're not ready. And so actually an interim can help them get ready. So that, because I'm convinced that a lot of the folks who fail, it's that institution wasn't ready. And now sometimes wrong person being hired for the wrong thing. But I mm-hmm. think sometimes awesome, terrific people are hired in the institute. So I just got to start on that talent pool. And there are right now in Whitney world, three types of institutions in higher ed. The ones going from great to greater, mm-hmm. those going from good to great. And then there are those that are right now hot, toxic messes. I will let listeners decide
what their institution is.
Yes, you get to pick. Okay. But I can tell you right now, the hot toxic messes, or maybe just their messes and not toxic, which I hope, an interim, somebody who is dedicated to the culture shifting we've already talked about, to the table setting or the table cleaning, to installing best practices, to being the courageous, ethical leader, knowing they're not sacrificing a career. They're not sacrificing maybe a 5 or 7 or 8 year appointment down to 2. That's mm-hmm. where particularly what I'll call the outside professional interim could bring to an institution. And yeah, I look forward to talking about the internal versus the outside interim. But so it's a talent pool challenge, but it's also the institutional readiness challenge. And I think we should always keep both connected.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And that idea of those three types of institutions, that is a great way to consider this. And as someone who I know who's done a lot of interim work will come in and say, every institution in its own dose, it's crazy. And it's absolutely true. You just have to understand what kind of dose of crazy you are, even if you are one of those great institutions, there's still a little bit of crazy running around. In the book, you talk about two pieces of advice to ready yourself for the interim. And when I saw this in the book, I said, okay, this is how you kind of get into the headspace. This is how the institution gets into the headspace. And there's two of them that you've put out there. One about it, be careful about who is picked. And Pat, I want to go to you on this. And then I want to talk to Karen about the second one. But Pat, that idea of being careful about who's picked, that they can bring more harm than good to the institution. And you talk about two elements that the person has to have. They have to have expertise, but they also have to have humility. Talk to us about that humility piece. Obviously, we'll get into expertise when we're talking about internal versus external and all that. But talk about humility and why that's so important in this.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think that what an interim can do, and Karen just nailed it really well. We'll just go back to a minute to that Boston College, the woman's been there for 35 years. Yep. You're following a legend. The last thing I want to do is follow a legend. But an interim can come in and set the table for the new person, make some of the tough decisions that might not have been made. I'm not saying that didn't happen. If there's personality issues that are sticky, make sure that people feel secure about the future, and that gives them time to find the right person. What we're finding is people are picking presidents way too quickly.
Yep.
I interviewed a guy about a year ago. He had been in his fifth interview for presidency. And I said, well, that sounds peculiar to me. Why would you do that? I mean, these are all mission-driven places that really attract your values and your principles. And he said, no, I just want to be a president. That's the last guy you want as the president of your institution. So that's where these search firms have really got to do their jobs really well. Mm-hmm. Because an attitude like that is a career killer. I mean, or a cultural killer. And the notion around humility, I think, especially men, and what it's worth about humility comes from strength. It doesn't come from weakness.
Yes.
When you think of people like Mandela, you think about the Pope and the Catholic Church, strong, intellectually strong, tough, kind, and very humble. Mm-hmm. So the humility is really that you're a learner. And for that first bucket of time, whether it be 6 months or a year, because the honeymoon period is no longer there because higher ed is moving so fast. There were a while there, you had a honeymoon for 9 months or maybe 12 and things were fine. Hey, Mr. Pat, how you doing? Good to see you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Day one, you're going to be leading. And that's where the experienced person can come in and say, all right, let's relax. I know what this looks like a little bit. I don't know everything, but we can move things forward and then build a relational capital. That's the key in an interim or any president or any senior leader's got to do. But to build a relational capital, I think you do have to have a sense of humility that I'm here to learn. What about your culture is unique? And how can I make sure that I serve the mission of this place as well as possible?
Mm-hmm. And I think what happens with that, too, is if they have humility, they know they're going to be passing off the ball to the next person.
Absolutely.
That helps with the transition. It's going to be like, all right, let me tell you a few things I've seen. Let me tell you what you might kind of not understand entirely yet. Let's kind of using your descriptions here is set that table. And make sure that someone is sitting down and you're like, oh, we're having seafood tonight? Yes, we're having seafood. Oh, I thought we were going to have prime rib. Nope. Tonight is a seafood night. And let me tell you why. And that allows for that better transition. If you go in thinking you're going to have something, I think that there's a piece there. I also think, because I'm somebody who's always about the intersections of where we exist, knowing that I think it's around 40% of the institutions in the United States enroll under 1,500 students right now or 2,000. It's small. Those are institutions that I think would be ripe for an interim president because you're in a reality that is, we've got to make some tough decisions, but also you got to really feel out what you need in a permanent in that case. Pat, what do you think about that? And then I want to get on to the next question with Karen.
I agree completely with what you just said, but Karen said something very important. If I'm an interim, I can have courage.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you're a bully or you make, oh, well, I'm just going to change things. But if the faculty get upset, I can say, listen, this is the facts. This is the rationale. This is why we're doing this. I'm going to listen very carefully to you, but we're not going to kick this. I've heard 100 times from presidents, you kick the can down the road. And then I come in and there's 15 cans I got to clean up. So I mean, the interim can say with courage and integrity, I have to make some tough decisions here with support of the board. I mean, the board can't waver with that. And I've seen that happen too. Start making some pretty interesting conversation. Not just me, they're not making mean decisions. They're making the hard decisions that have been avoided oftentimes. The board can kind of get, oh, I'm not sure we need to do this right now. And it's not a good situation. So the board support is important, but the courage that the interim has in the in that limited time is a gift. It is absolutely a gift.
And I think that that gets us a good transition to the next question, which I want to pose to Karen, is your second recommendation, your second piece of advice to try to ready yourself for that interim has to do with the board. It also has to do with senior administration and faculty and that sort of thing. But that idea of getting to the search firm, getting to the placement organization to be able to put out there and have the questions available that are, these are the aspects of our existence that we need a strong person to understand. We, in order for this to be a fit, we need them to know this. You work for the registry, you place interims. How hard is it for people to actually have that on? I mean, it's like, okay, look at yourself in the mirror and tell me the worst part of you. Okay. And how do you actually get them to acknowledge that in a way that's productive?
Well, I actually think in what Pat was saying is how hard and fast and quick and overwhelming our industry is enveloped right now. Things are running faster. Again, the convention was you want, as a president, you would pace and base. You'd pace yourself for year one to be the honeymoon year. By the way, I thought I had a 2-year honeymoon when I was a Clarendon. And you had a pace. You built your base of relationships and then over it used to be more like 8 to 10 years, you would do your job. Now, I mean, I think people are finding maybe even a solid time at being a president is more like 6 years or 5 years. The ACE survey on average for all presidents was 5.9 years. Ask you public regional universities, which are under intense fire right now, intense challenges, are barely at 5. So yes. I think pace and base has changed. To your point, though, I think clarity, the number one word I'll use that challenges leaders and challenges institutions is clarity, clarity of purpose, clarity of desired outcomes. And I'm not talking goals, okay? I'm too old for goals. I'm at this point in life where I want to talk about what do we desire to achieve? What are the results we're going toward? That's the marker I look at. A goal is what you intend to do, or it's just overarching. I'm like, no, we want to close the retention gap 2%. We want 98% occupancy. We want Black men to graduate at the same rate as white men. We want. And I don't mind that. I mean, there's a lot of folks in higher ed that kind of freak out on that kind of clarity because there can be accountability. And much like we're at the taping right now, we're about to be into the Super Bowl. There is score taking and there are winners and losers. I'm okay with that because the stakes are high. So the thing about working with a board, working with senior administration or faculty that an interim can bring is actually greater clarity because the nature of an appointment, an interim, and this is one reason I love doing interim leadership for myself and doing placements, is there's a beginning and an end. There's a box. And in that box, whether it's 6 months, 9, 18, I served as an interim chancellor for 24. There's a box. There's a pace. There can be clarity of desired outcomes. And so a lot of times when a client, a president or vice president or a board chair contacts me, says, Karen, I think we want an interim leader. First thing I talk about is clarity of desired outcomes. What is it you would hope this interim will get done during the appointment period you're thinking?
Yeah.
And that surprises people because they're often thinking, I need a couple of more. I don't have any depth in my bench anymore because of this turnstile of leadership. And so I'm calling you, but we want to run at getting the next regular person as fast as possible. Big mistake. And so maybe 9 months, just a placeholder, but the opportunity can be incredibly consequential. So I do a lot of that kind of chatting and reframing with people. And when it works, it is beautiful. And it really helps the institution be healthier, then enables the person who gets the next appointment to have a better shot at a great appointment at a president having a really good presidency or a vice president or provost. That's the opportunity of what you're asking, Laura, around clarity with the board and the senior leadership. and actually amazingly smart people, I have to work really hard with them to help them get clear. They're often muddled and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And that's made worse since the pandemic. The pandemic's made that worse.
I bet. Pat, you've got some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I would just build on something that Karen actually contributed a big chunk into this book that we did. I think it's one of the gifts in the book. If an interim or even a new president, people have to know, what's this person supposed to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
And what Karen in the book, what she met when she was the chancellor out in the University of Illinois, she had a 2 or 3 page document that she made public that said, these are the goals, objectives, and preferred outcomes that we're looking for.
Yeah.
Well, now people know, because when I was the board member, the sister institution, the guy was wandering around all the time and going into meetings and talking about big visions. And I'm saying, buddy, you're only going to be here for a year. You're going to confuse people and scare the bejesus out of them.
No, it's Karen about had getting shit done.
And it also held Karen accountable, right? Which is a word that is always a little scary in higher education. But people could open up and say, these are 6 or 7 things. I think you're over aspirational, Karen, I think, but you did pull it off. But I think just a 2-page document says, this is what the charge is or the charter is for this person here, what they're going to look for and what they're going to try to do. Then people would say, well, I can help them do that, as opposed to it being some kind of mystery.
Yeah. And I think going back to my point about all the intersections that this kind of thing can help with, we're at a crisis of trust in higher education right now.
Absolutely.
People don't trust what we do. And if you have somebody come in capable, vision, has a vision, understands what are the priorities, is able to say, here's our marching orders. This is what we're going to accomplish in the next 2 years so that we can set the table for the next person. And that from a environment is creating a higher sense of accountability, a higher sense, hopefully, of the trust, not only on the institution side, but also on the external, and may heighten the interest that a candidate may have for that particular job. Because if you have, some people think of it, and I think it's, there is a part of this that is true in interim work, that it's cleaning up messes and fixing this and maybe moving some people along. But that's simplifying it. That is oversimplifying it. And if you're able to do this effectively, that person coming in is actually heightening, it's almost a return on investment, right? Oh. It's like I'm selling the house and I know I'm not going to use this second bathroom. I haven't used it in a long time, but that's going to increase the value of the house. So fix the bathroom. The person is fixing the bathroom and it's bringing the value of the position, the value of the institution up. Am I off base here?
No, I think you're going to say, I think that's often a case. The other thing that can happen, given the nature of higher ed, we just have things on our plate no matter who's in charge or not. And I think what an interim can do is ensure that institutional priorities are moving ahead without skipping a beat.
Yeah.
That sometimes it all just depends on the circumstance of why there's an opening. And so the idea of accrediting agencies are still going to accredit no matter who's in leadership. Enrollment has to be tended to no matter who's in leadership, no matter. So the idea, it can be restorative and reparative. And it can also be, depending on where the institution is, that it ensures the advancement of the priorities don't falter, that there's no cracks.
Right.
Because again, it depends on how, because I see openings for a variety of reasons. Sometimes openings are because someone retires. Sometimes an opening is some people are, let's say, released from their obligations suddenly. Sometimes people pass away, you know, in their position.
Yeah.
I mean, there are stories here. And so it is actually everything. There are percent of the placements I'm doing solid, great organizations. And from a strength standpoint, this is the best thing. The board chair or the president says, from a strength standpoint, I want to strategically bring in someone very talented to advance this, and this. And I think that's it. The other, probably the most common one, are searches that don't go as planned and they suddenly need somebody. And that gets back to our earlier comment about challenges of talent pools and the whole search industry, which needs to take a hard, hard look at itself. And I don't know, Laura, I forgive me. I don't know if you've interviewed anybody from the search industry, but if you haven't, good idea.
Good idea. Yes. There's a few people we could call up on that one. Let's talk about interims and where they come from. There's that interim from the internal. Boston University is doing that right now. They had an internal person. They said they ran but this comes from your idea of like the pool wasn't there. So they ran a search. There was a person they brought in from the outside. There was a person they brought in from the inside. They had that opportunity, but didn't happen. I don't know all the, I wasn't in the room. I don't know exactly what happened, but here we go. So then they decided to take somebody who had been well known within the institution to have this past year. And now they have announced that they have a new president coming in. So you have your interim who is internal. Then you have the external. Talk to us. And this person could have a deep understanding of the institution, or they may have no idea, but they may have those elements of skill and capacity that you've talked about. What are the benefits of going internal with an interim versus an external and vice versa? So either of you can take that.
I have a particular perspective, but I don't know what Karen's is, so this will be kind of interesting. I think if I have a criticism of higher ed, and I'm a fan, I've been around for 30 plus years, and I've been blessed with a great career with great leaders, is that we have not built the pool, the bench, as it were, they do in the corporate sector. I was talking to a young man today, about 40 years old. He's going to be a VP pretty soon. He's been in three different countries. He knows, he's a brilliant young man and a very humble young man. Yeah. And he's going to make a great senior VP in about 2 years with about 18,000 people under his buck. I don't think that we build the bench in higher education. Mm-hmm. I have a strong bias or prejudice, what do you want to call that? I like internal candidates personally because first of all, you said, Laura, they're trusted. Now they got to be trusted, right? They got to be
right.
Oh, there's good old Pat again.
Oh, they brought in that asshole. Great.
Yeah,
want that. You want somebody people trust. Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, Temple University, I'm going to remember a guy, Richard Leinhardt, I think his name. He's been around for like 50 years. A great guy. I think he's been the interim president and the interim chancellor six times in 20 years.
Yeah.
They bring this guy in because he's deeply trusted. He can stand it. The problem is they can't pick good ones. So they've gone through two presidencies really badly. So I tend to like the internal if they're competent and people trust them. And if they do, stabilize things and then go for someone who's really got some great talent. And I think that's the best mix, personally, for me.
Okay.
Karen, what are your
thoughts?
On internal interims, to me, the best internal interim is what Pat's described, is the elder senior states person who is internally trusted there. And also the key here is they genuinely do not want the regular position.
Right.
And in fact, I'm going to finish the story on why I say this. I had a policy as president that, to the chagrin of some, that if someone agreed to be an interim, they'd have to agree not to apply.
Yep.
And let me go down the road on, I've seen it. And so that's the best person. When I was at Clarion University for 7 years, I announced that I was going to have one more year, eight. Quite frankly, I felt like I had done my best work, what I was hired to do. And it was a tough, tough, tough assignment and beautiful and wonderful. But I needed to put that to closure for myself on many levels. Instead, they asked me to be that last year, the interim chancellor for the system. I already had said I'm exiting. I had the credibility and the trust that Pat described. It was an excellent and productive appointment. So that's a good example. The thing you don't want to do is offer to an interim the idea of try before you buy and a junior person to try them out for the position.
Exactly.
A couple of reasons you don't want to do that is unless you've already decided, unless this person flubs up, they'll get it, which at state universities, you're often prohibited from doing that by law because you're required to do competitive open searches and even best practice and that trusting of a search process. So if you allow a junior person to be interim and they give you either blood, sweat, and tears, okay, and I have coach and work with people in these examples I'm giving you. So I'm not just speculating. And they do it. They give their blood, sweat, and tears. They apply because you told them they could. And maybe they thought they were getting signals and they get it. Okay, winner, winner, chicken dinner. Okay, that's great for them. But I've also seen where people don't get it. That was the right thing to do. The search process actually did locate an even better person. And that person is left feeling, think about it, horrible, dejected, humiliated, embarrassed. And I can tell you, I've got two situations where that leader who gave their blood, sweat, and tears as an interim left as fast as they could.
Yep.
So the institution actually lost.
Yep.
Big time.
Yep.
And they lost. And so I don't believe in allowing people who are junior, try before you buy an interim. That is a bad idea. Elder, senior statesperson who has already exited or is committed, that can be terrific. That's my thoughts on that. Takes a certain discipline because the junior people want it and they think that's their way to get in. And you just have to keep saying, no, do your job. If you want to be provost, do your job as dean. If you want to be VP, do your job as assistant VP and be part of the process in a clean, separate way. So that comments on that.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is also very transferable to other positions. We see this time and time again, that try before you buy. I'm writing all these Whitneyisms down, by the way, because it's like setting the table, try before you buy. I'm going to try to use these all day after this. Anyway, but that idea of try before you buy, we see that happen time and time and time again. And it has only gotten worse since the pandemic, when there's been so much of that Tetris game happening on campuses where one person's moving and this person's over here and all of that's happening. And they don't want to lose somebody, but they don't know what they want to do. Or they don't care if they lose somebody, but they also don't want to have too much of an opening somewhere else. And so it's irresponsible. It's not great for the community. It's not great for the culture. It's not great for people's peace of mind. And it's not great for the person. And you do need to have strong leadership who's able to come in and be able to say, look, Laura, I know that you've shown some interest in being the interim. Do you want this job? Yes. Okay. Well, we have now instituted an institutional policy that is this. And this is actually to protect our best people and our best interests. This isn't a slap to you. This is telling the institution, we take this seriously. We want to have an interim who doesn't have skin in the game and all of that, because it just creates, we already know what an internal candidate goes through in an interview process and how much all the bullshit and the internal politics and people. And this was years ago when I was on a small college campus and we had an internal candidate going for a dean's position. And I was at one of those miserable open meetings with the community, which I have so many feelings about, as you can tell. But there was a person there who I swear just showed up for the buffet and was like, oh, I have a question for the internal candidate. We want you. You're the one we really want. But I'm like, why are we allowing this? You want to talk a little about transition and that aspect of transition. And one of the things you put in the book is you've interviewed over 50 presidents, and derailers of a presidential transition is a cultural mismatch. Yeah. And like, so let's talk a little bit about what that means and how this, we've talked a little bit about cleaning up the table and all of that and cleaning the space, but the transition elements of all of this is a key component of this book. We've talked a lot about the interim piece, but that transitional piece is so important. And the culture is one piece, but what about some of the other aspects of derailment that have come up, and how much of it is, we all hear from people that the actual investment in filling a position is so expensive. And how is that going to happen? How does that kind of return on investment, that protecting what you're doing in terms of hiring folks, that transition, what are those key things you've learned in the writing of this book that the transition needs to keep in mind, the transition team needs to keep in mind? And we'll start with Karen and then we'll go to Pat.
Well, I think particularly as it relates to the value that an interim leader can bring is often when I work with interim leaders and their placement, we look at the interim leader as a consulting leader. And so one of the things they can do, if the institution and those who decide these things can organize the search, because an interim is an interim. So there's always going to be the next person coming in. That's clear. So the idea is onboarding, which we don't do very well or consistently. The idea that the interim then as a consultant can be that bridge for the regularly appointed person. Like as I finished my 2-year appointment in Illinois, I had a wonderful a month with Janet Gooch, who was hired as the regular chancellor for University of Illinois Springfield. And we kept in contact. And actually, she is now in her second year. We are still, we talk about every 4 to 6 weeks as part. Now, that's pretty generous, but I mean, I'm committed to her. I was there for 2 years. I care. It's personal. And that's also with outside interims. It's still personal. because you've done the work. And so I think it's that idea, to your point, about how can we support our leaders, our regularly appointed leaders, during times of intense transition, that using the interim as a consultant to bridge through, because again, and Pat said this, we don't have skin in the game. Mm-hmm. We're honest brokers of what we're seeing, of the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of the institution, and how the institution can achieve its priorities and its mission. But I think there is that opportunity there with an interim, with a regularly appointed, that I'm seeing more and more. And in fact, as we curate the assignments with interims, with the registry, we put that into the expectations of a good assignment. Yes, it's clear. One of the things you get with an outside interim and a firm, I think, is the clarity of what is it you're being hired to do. And everybody has it. We encourage sharing and making it transparent, although some organizational cultures are more transparent than others. Right. In Whitney world, the transparency that Pat described is the best way, I think. But I think that transparency and that commitment to onboarding the next is very important to the overall health of the institution. Yeah. So it's not just simply being a bench warmer. It's actually leaving the institution healthier and more capable of achieving mission.
Yeah. Pat, as a follow-up, is that what you see a successful transition being? Do you see a successful transition being a place that not only has almost a connected tissue to the interim, or what does it actually look like to you?
I think there's three things that the interim needs to pay attention to, or any new president, but an interim has got some experience. The first thing is, what's the culture of this institution? And every institution is different. Higher ed's got 4,000 campuses, and I've been in about 500 of them doing things.
Yeah.
Each one is unique and different. If I'm a new leader, if I don't figure that out, I'm going to be in trouble. The second thing is, how do I, as the new person, I'm a stranger. Right? My senior team are a bunch of strangers. I'm going to inherit a senior team. I had no idea of how to choose them. How do I build the relational capital that's authentic, right? So that people, you said before, trust me, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's competent. Everyone's smart in higher education for the most part, but the relational capital is huge. And then how do things get actually done? So there's always an org chart, right? And this person knows kind of how the operations work. But we call it the adhocracy. Who are the players? Who are the decision makers, really? Who are the people, go-to people? And if the person doesn't figure out those things, and in the book we talk about how to do that, those three buckets are really important. Can I just give you a quick example?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we talked about this before. This notion around the cultural piece is important. And so the search firm or the HR department, before the person comes on board, would identify 5, 7, 9. It wouldn't be 55, and it wouldn't be 2. What we call cultural travelers, those kinds of people that can go throughout the campus, have good relationships with faculty, with staff, with administration. They're trusted. They represent the best of the place. And if the new person can have a conversation with them, hopefully face-to-face before they come on board, it's a pre-boarding kind of thing, or on a Zoom meeting, and ask a set of questions like, tell me a story about this place that enables me to understand what's important here. What are the lived values here? How do you gain credibility here? What about the history of this place is something we have to preserve at all costs? I mean, it's only about 3 or 4 or 5 really good questions with people who are identified as these cultural bearers, not blockages, not curmudgeons, because we got plenty of them too in higher education, but people who serve the mission and love the place and have huge credibility. A conversation with those people, only about 6 or 7 of those people will give you a sense of what are the non-negotiables here, what's the culture that I need to understand. So that's a strategy you can use as an interim or even a new president coming into a place. That makes sense the way I framed it.
I absolutely love that. And I think one of the things that you were both talking about, it got me thinking, and I want to ask this question. We haven't talked about it before. Is you all have talked about how, obviously, the interim president, but we've also got places for interim provost, interim CFO, or interim whatever. Is there a possibility, because of this problem with lineage and problem of backfilling in terms of positions, that an institution is going to have more than one interim at a time? And if that's the case, what are your thoughts on multiple interims at the same time? Do you feel like they should come in as almost, Karen used the football analogy earlier, when a football coach leaves, they bring in their entire coaching staff, okay? Do you see this as an opportunity to bring in a team of interims? Is that overwhelming for the institution? Or is there a space where you say, there's too many interims, we've got to wait? Or I don't know. I'm having a tough time, but what are your thoughts?
Let me give you a kind of on ground. When I was at University of Illinois Springfield. I was interim. That was an outside. We needed a CFO, vice president for finance and administration. He was from the outside. We had a circumstance where we needed an interim vice president for student affairs. I asked the number two person to be interim. And she upfront agreed that she would not apply for it. She didn't want to apply for it.
Okay.
So in that case, I think that's where you have to use your judgment and smarty smarts about what's the chemistry, but also what's the talent on your current bench and what are we trying to do? And it was the pandemic and there were just circumstances. So in my particular case, we did a combination. I've seen other situations where they're all from the outside. I think you have to look at talent bench, what you're trying to achieve in the circumstances. And then that can kind of curate the team. So there's no one answer. Then I would follow the internal rules or guidance we gave earlier on internal candidates. If you do that, then it's just, what do you have? What I think is very clear now is even not just the 1,500 enrollment or 2,000 enrollment, but I'll even say, I'm seeing at the 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000 enrollment institutions, they don't have the leadership depth on the bench. Or it is an exhausted bench. It is post-pandemic. Right. It is exhausted. And people are saying, not me. I'm exhausted. And before the pandemic, someone might say out of a sense of servant leadership or a sense of or ambition, they guess, sure. But I think right now, you're seeing that more and more they're looking toward a variety of not your usual junior people. So,
yeah. Do you see an opportunity for people who don't have a higher education lineage coming into these interim roles, or do you think that's too disruptive?
I wouldn't. Well, this is funny. My first reaction is no, because one of the things that, for example, with the registry, you only get placed in positions you've already held. So there is no try before you buy. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to be interim a chancellor if I hadn't been a president or chancellor. And that gives the leg up on what both you and Pat have been saying about trusted experience. And while I might not know the state or the community or the campus, I know how to be a president. And that idea, then I already have an advanced way forward on understanding the culture, building relationships, understanding the operation. As I like to say, it's not my first rodeo. And that's what I think becomes important. I am a skeptic in any condition that someone outside of higher ed, that their very first job in higher ed is to take a leadership position at the president and vice president level. That's kind of like saying, quite frankly, yes, sure, be the president of our United States as your starter job in politics. I'm not thrilled about that either. Okay.
I just don't think that worked out so well.
So my point is, it's not a starter job. It's insulting to consider it a starter job. And there is a craft here of leadership in higher ed that is important and valuable.
Important point. Pat.
I would agree. I've seen a couple of bad ones at the University of South Carolina. They had a 2-star general come in and he hit the wall about 90 miles an hour. Changed everything, a military model in the higher education. So, Karen, exactly. I think now I have seen some external CFOs and chief business officers come in from the corporate sector, and they know money. They understand things. And they have a lot of credibility. But when you're talking about the academy or the academic side of the house, I've seen about a half a dozen over the years, and it just doesn't work.
It's risky.
Political appointee, some governor that changes their philosophy, and then we all bring him here to kind of do this thing, you will lose your faculty. And that's what's happened to a number of really high profile places.
Pat, I'm going to give you the last word. It's your book. It's your name on it. So what do you want people to know and who should be reading this book?
I think it's a very practical book. And once again, with Karen's work and Mary Hinton's out of Holland University, Dorothy Escobano is one of the great ladies of higher education at St. College of New Rochelle, Steve Titus. So I was very smart in picking really good people stuff. And all the stuff is tested, right? This is not like, well, let's see if this kind of works. This has been tested and it kind of works. And they're easy to understand. You've read the book, Laura, and it's not a complicated book. It's not an encyclopedia. It's a toolbox that people can use.
Yes.
And I think that's really important to do. And I think we've got to learn how to transition people better, because we're going through a very difficult time right now in higher education. Post-COVID is going to continue going on. Things aren't going to get easier. We're going to need competent people in positions, and we need to support them. And the more that they can learn fast, connect with people, and appreciate the culture, and to be as transparent as possible, we will see some successful transitions. But so hopefully the book will help new people think about the strategies behind building the relational capital and understand the complexity of the institution.
I think anybody who's on a presidential search committee or someone who might be tapped needs to read this in advance. I think anybody who is a college trustee needs to have a copy of this book. And I absolutely think that the folks in the HR office learn from this too. So Koopa, listen up. You need to be getting this out to your chief human resources people. So Karen Whitney and Pat Sanagan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And this was wonderful. That was a great show. As I said, I truly believe that this book is a must-read for anyone in higher education, human resources offices, people at the cabinet level, or people aspiring to the cabinet level. If you happen to be asked to serve on a transitional committee, there's so many people who could benefit from this. But most importantly, people on the boards of trustees and overseers really need to get their hands on a copy of this book. I could listen to Pat and Karen for another hour, and I hope to bring them back to another show in the future. So I want to thank you for being an Office Hours listener. In order to grow our community, please rate, review, and share the podcast for your network. And I would really appreciate if you could give that show a little bit of a rating. That really helps us. Today's show, all of the notes are in the show notes, including a link to how to buy the book. And I want to ask you to follow me on social media and become a subscriber to my newsletter on Substack. And I want to thank our wonderful producer, David Yaz. Office Hours is a production of Pod 617 Studios in Westwood, Massachusetts. So now get out there and learn something.